Blog Talk Radio.
Here we are. This week, new unemployment legislation passes the Senate, extending benefits to 200,000 Americans. Oddly, the Republicans didn't filibuster. Sadly, civil rights activist and former head of the NAACP, Benjamin Hooks, has died. New cases of E. coli infections were down in 2009, according to the Centers for Disease Control. Apparently, the economy is affecting people's ability to buy fast food. Republican candidate for New York Governor Carl Paladino gave a non-apology this week, saying that the racist and sexist emails he was found to have sent don't truly represent who he is. I apologize, he said, to anyone who was offended. He then said that his opponents don't want to talk about the issues. Larry King and his wife are divorcing. That's his seventh wife. Larry, when I realized I was no good at basketball, I stopped trying slam dunks. No offense, but get a clue. Governor Charlie Crist of Florida may be getting ready to run for the U.S. Senate as an independent, according to some sources. Would this be considered the second running of Crist? I'm just asking. The United Nations has been studying for some time. You're going to have to think about that last one. It's actually, well, never mind. The United Nations has been studying for some time the assassination of former Prime Minister of Pakistan, Benazir Bhutto. They've concluded that she was provided inadequate security. Should we say it together? Duh. Louisiana porn star Stormy Daniels has announced that she won't be running in the GOP primary for Senate in Louisiana against Senator David Vitter. Now, that would have been an interesting race. In making her announcement, she complained that the media weren't taking her seriously. She might have a point. Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea, welcome to Speaking of Everything with Jeff Bushman. That would be moi. All that, news of the weird, and our guest, novelist Joe Traum, who's published a book called Waking Up, the story of a real estate agent whose son is kidnapped and murdered. And that's just the start, so stay tuned for that and more. But first, if you have a website and aren't blogging, you're missing the best thing you can do to drive eyeballs to your website and dollars to your bottom line. You can do it yourself for free, or you can have a professional writer do your blogging for you for under $100 a month. Go to jeffonblogging.blogspot.com and read all about it. Again, that's jeffonblogging.blogspot.com. Welcome to the show. And I want to welcome any of the new listeners that we have had join us recently. And I suppose I shouldn't say I'm surprised, but I am. Apparently we've had quite a few join us recently. So thank you for that and hope you stay with us in spite of the host. Wanted to talk about those headlines we discussed a little bit, but I also wanted to invite you to call in case you'd like to talk about anything happening in politics this week or generally. Or you can speak about something else. That's why the show is called Speaking of Everything, and we speak of almost everything. There are a couple of subjects I would just as soon avoid, but as a general rule, we pretty much cover the gamut, or nearly the gamut. And the number to call in is area code 347-994-3796. We talked about Benjamin Hooks. Benjamin Hooks was the leader of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. That's what the organization is still called, although usually they just go by the initials. It is a group of which I am a member, and Benjamin Hooks unfortunately died. He's been out of the NAACP leadership for a number of years because he was elderly, but he headed that organization from the 70s until the beginning of this century, so he was there for quite a while, and he did what is generally believed to be a very good job. Let's see, Governor Charlie Crist, Florida, is running for the United States Senate right now as a Republican, because he is a Republican, attempting to get the Republican nomination for the U.S. Senate. He has been challenged by a teabagger by the name of Marco Rubio, and Rubio is now ahead in the polls. And Crist, by the way, who has been governor of Florida, as mentioned, was considered for quite some time as a possible running mate for John McCain, during the 2008 election, and as you'll remember, he ultimately, McCain that is, chose Sarah Palin, showing his great judgment. But Charlie Crist was passed up, and he's decided to run for the U.S. Senate, and then has been challenged, as mentioned, by a member of the Tea Party, Marco Rubio, as a Republican. There is some talk about Crist running as an independent. He has denied that for quite some time, but today he vetoed a bill that would have stripped tenure from teachers and made some other reforms that conservative Republicans are thrilled, would have been thrilled about. The former governor of Florida, Jeb Bush, favored the bill, and Crist obviously didn't, and he's vetoed it. And the general thinking is that he's killed his chances of winning the Republican nomination, if he had one before, for the U.S. Senate. So he may end up running as an independent. And that's basically what's happening there. And if he does, it is pretty clear he would get, in addition to some Republican votes and some independent votes, he's probably going to get some Democratic votes by reason of this veto that he entered today. David Vitter is a senator from Louisiana, and unfortunately at the moment the name, it just came back to me, the name of the other senator is Mary Landrieu. You may remember hearing about her during the healthcare debate. In any event, she's a Democrat, and Vitter is a Republican, and Vitter is the gentleman who was implicated, it must be 2 years ago now, in a scandal, because his name was found in the little black book of the madam of a prostitution ring. Vitter never admitted that he was a customer. On the other hand, he didn't say he wasn't. But anyway, he never admitted he was a customer, but acknowledged that he, quote-unquote, had sinned and apologized to his wife and the public and Tiger Woods, I think. He apologized to everybody. excuse me. We, as I mentioned, in about, I guess it's less than 20 minutes now, thankfully, Joe Traum will be joining us, and if you are interested in knowing a little more about his novel called Waking Up, first off, listen to us, but if you happen to be sitting at your computer, and of course you are, you may want to look at his website, but please keep listening, and the website is joetraum, TRAUM.com. Getting back to the thrust of the news, we very often talk about odd stories and often go to News of the Weird. We have mentioned their website just about every week because we feel we have to credit them if we're going to kind of steal stories or borrow stories from them. And the main website for them is still the same, newsoftheweird, all one word, .com, but they've now opened up what they call News of the Word Pro Edition, and you can get there and see some at least equally strange stories, and that's at newsoftheweird.blogspot.com. So if you want to avail yourself of those stories during the week until you join us again next week, of course, feel free. One of the things about newsoftheweird.com that I commend to your attention is that there are videos on the site that clearly we can't do justice to here, and there are some pictures, and one of those pictures has to do with this next story in that they show the fellow's face in makeup. You now have the ability to hire an evil clown for your child's birthday party. Dominic DeVille is the gentleman's name. He will stalk the honoree with letters, texts, and phone calls before the party. Then he'll show up and smash the child in the face with a birthday cake. My first thought is maybe, just maybe, this guy went into the wrong business. He should probably be marrying Larry King's ex-wives. I don't know, but this is not the kind of clown I'd want to have at a birthday party, but maybe your opinion differs. The side note I made to myself was, have you ever wondered what would happen if the clown in Stephen King's novel, It, were in a library, and the librarian had to ask him by name to be quiet? Instead of saying, shh, Tommy, as she might to someone else, well, I'll let you take it from there. Speaking of Florida, as we were earlier, a Florida legislator I love this story. A Florida legislator has introduced a bill that would stop promoting middle school students to high school. I should mention, if any of you is of a generation where they didn't have middle school, that's like junior high. And in some areas, they cover 7th, 8th, and 9th, and some just 8th and 9th, and others just 7th and 8th. It's peculiarized, if you will, or particularized, more correctly, by different school districts. Some of them have it, you know, at different times. In any event, a legislator introduced a bill that would stop promoting middle school students to high school if they're as dumb about civics as those shown on Jay Leno's jaywalking segment on The Tonight Show. As many of you know, Jay Leno will go out on the street near his studios and ask people on the street questions that don't really require an enormous amount of political sophistication, and it's amazing how many adults cannot answer simple questions. In any event, that's what the legislation is promoting, basically, is better civics education. They want to stop promoting middle school students who can't answer some simple questions in civics. What's not said is that there's actually a governmental advantage to not promoting those students, because it would greatly reduce the amount of money necessary to fund high school graduation ceremonies. Speaking of peculiar laws, and we were, it was discovered recently that there is a 1949 piece of legislation still on the books in California. It requires state health officials to attempt to find a cure for homosexuality. And you thought this was recent. Nope, that's from 1949. By the way, to show you the effectiveness of this law, as far as I know, they still haven't found it. Also, a prosecutor, our last story of the weird, a prosecutor in a small Wisconsin county has announced that he would prosecute teachers who follow the state-approved sex education curriculum. At about this point, you should be asking why. And the answer is because they would be contributing to the delinquency of minors. If you follow the curriculum, you can... Anyway, that's his theory. Apparently, he's not happy about the state-approved sex education curriculum. Since we have some time, I wanted to talk about something related to today and the Tea Party and all of that. And again, you're welcome to join me if you wish. I would love to hear from a member of the Tea Party, as a matter of fact, or any of the organizations associated with it. If you consider yourself a teabagger, and I mean that in a political sense, please feel free to call us at 347-994-3796, and I would put you on the air, assuming you call within about the next 10 minutes, which is before Joe Traum joins us. Wanted to talk a bit, as I say, about today's occurrences. Today is April 15th. Of course, it is the day on which most people file their, or the day by which most people file their income tax return. And the day has been picked by Tea Party activists to hold demonstrations across the country protesting what they determine to be excessive government spending. And they want government spending cut so they don't have to pay so much in taxes. A couple of things come to mind that thought I would discuss with you. First off, as a country, taxpayers in this country are not taxed highly as compared to other countries. Arguably, you may still feel we're too highly taxed. That's certainly your right to have that opinion. But as compared to other countries, we are not as highly taxed. Europe, for example, is more highly taxed in terms of gasoline taxes. They pay an additional tax related to health care because they actually have sensible, intelligent health care in those countries called single payer or national health or various things like that. They also fund government television and radio, not with voluntary contributions, but with a tax they charge in Britain, for example, each year for the support of the BBC, and they have something similar in Canada for the CBC. None of those things are done here. We pay fewer taxes overall, but many people, such as the Tea Party folks, feel we're too highly taxed because government is spending too much. The fact is that because of all of the deficits racked up by both parties for many years, we do in fact have a potential crisis down the road. We may have a situation in which the amount of money to service the debt is too high relative to gross domestic product to have a healthy economy. So we do have to make some cuts and or increase taxes. This is not rocket science. It's math. The teabagging type people object to any increase in taxes. So if they hold sway, the obvious question is, where do we cut spending? My question to you, if you believe that we need to cut spending, is which government service that you receive are you willing to give up or have reduced? And if the answer is, well, no, not mine, I'm talking about somebody else's, then you're clearly not serious about cutting spending. The fact is, yes, government does waste some money, but not a lot as a percentage in terms of the full government budget. And there is some abuse, and there are some violations of law. There are all kinds of things that go wrong with government, and there are many things that go right with government. But which government service are you willing to give up? Are you willing to give up ambulance service or police service or fire department or roads? Or are you willing to give up or have reduced your Medicare and Social Security? If the answer to that, or veterans benefits, by the way, if the answer to giving up Social Security or Medicare or reducing it is yes, that's great, but it doesn't count if you're not already receiving it. Because I can, not receiving that, those benefits now, I can fairly easily say, you know what, let's raise the retirement age from whatever it is now, it's about 66 and a half, I think, to 70. Let's raise it to 70 before anybody can receive Social Security benefits other than disability, just Social Security retirement. And that's fine, but it's really cheap for me to say that because I am not anticipating retirement. If you're 64, 65, or you're 70 now, and you are receiving Social Security benefits and Medicare or veterans benefits, which government benefit are you willing to give up? And if you're not in that category, and are in the same situation I am, which other government service are you willing to give up? Don't be willing to give up your friend's Medicare or your friend's food stamps. What are you willing to give up yourself? Unless most Americans are willing to give up something they're receiving, we will never cut spending. It's always a case of somebody else's benefit that people want to give up. So that's where it is. If that's the position you're in, wanting to give up somebody else's benefits, and you're not being intellectually honest, you have to be willing to give it up yourself. So with that in mind, we have about 5 minutes before Joe joins us, so if you'd like to join the conversation, you're more than welcome to do so. Or if you prefer not to, that's fine. By the way, I did mention that today's April 15th. That's only true if you're listening to the show when it's being recorded live. If not, then, of course, you can tell me what date it is because I have no idea. But if you are listening April 15th and wish to call in, again, the number is 347-994-3796. Next week, we have a guest by the name of Deanna Daly, and she's going to be talking to us about some of her writing. She has a published novel, and she's about to come out with a nonfiction book. But tonight, we're going to have Joe Traum, and I'm looking forward to that conversation. He has a lot of very interesting experiences he's going to share with us, as well as talking to us about his book. This is also the anniversary of a couple of things. First off, it's the anniversary of the death of Abraham Lincoln, and it's also the anniversary of the formation of what was originally called the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, known better by its acronym of SNCC. And it began as, in fact, a nonviolent civil rights group, which was mostly related to college students, but there were some people in the organization who were either above college age or were, in fact, not in college, though of the correct age. And they actually ended up desegregating a number of places by their action and by their willingness to risk injury and arrest. Back in the, well, I said it's the 50th anniversary, so that would take us to 1960. Among the famous people who was in that organization was Julian Bond, who was later a legislator and ambassador. Also in that organization, and the person who took it over later, was Stokely Carmichael. Stokely Carmichael didn't have the same generalized view about violence and nonviolence. He was somewhat less civil, if you will, in terms of what he felt civil rights action was necessary, and that very much changed the group. But it was formed 50 years ago. I said 50 years ago. That's right, 1960. 50 years ago today, that was the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. I had mentioned last time we were together that April was not a good month to be President of the United States. Hopefully for Barack Obama it will be and is, but it was on April 14th that Lincoln was shot, and April 15th on which he died, and he didn't even have to pay taxes on April 15th, so that's not the reason. And the April 12th date, which occurred a couple of days ago, was the day on which Franklin Roosevelt died in Warm Springs, Georgia, as a result of a cerebral hemorrhage. I was surprised the other day when I happened to run across a news story with regard to FDR. When he died, what would you guess his age was? If you look at pictures of him in the days of 1945, as a matter of fact, if you look at pictures of him during the 1944 election campaign, he looked sick and old and gaunt. And, of course, he had had polio for a number of years, but he looked horrible. And in 1945, when he died, if I had to have made a guess, I would have said 70, 71, 72. He was 63 years old. And that, I guess, shows you what the job does. If you look at pictures of Lyndon Johnson in 1963, when he took office, and then look at him again, in 1969 when he left office, the difference in 6 years, it was a little less than 6 years actually, is remarkable. The man aged terribly. Some would say he deserved to, but there's no question of the fact that the job itself aged him and ages most people who are in that job terribly. If you look at Bill Clinton in the 8 years he was president, even though he was fairly healthy when he left office, he had aged enormously, just for what it's worth. And Roosevelt, of course, was in worse shape by the time he died. In any event, we were talking, I believe, I'm sorry, we did mention Vitter, so we won't go after that again. By the way, Tiger Woods is going to be in another golf tournament in 2 weeks. The layoff between the Masters and this next golf tournament, which is the, I've forgotten the name of it, but something like the Open Quail golf tournament. Presumably this former vice president will not be participating in that. Quail Hollow, as a matter of fact, that's the name of it. The Quail, I've never heard of it either. But he's going to be in that, and presumably there will be a great deal of attention paid to the tournament because Tiger Woods is involved. And this is going to be one of those times when he is participating in a golf tournament, both now and during the Masters, where no one will have any question about where his balls are. They're going to be in the bag or on the tee or the fairway. That's the situation with Tiger. Joe Trump is due to join us any second, and that would be good because he would rescue me from that terrible joke. In any event, as I mentioned, we have Deanna Daly coming on next week, and for those of you who were listening previously, meaning last week, we had Larry Hancock on talking about the assassination of Robert Kennedy. He is going to be rejoining us on May 6th, which, speaking of anniversaries, I hope it's not considered auspicious. Speaking of anniversaries, that's the anniversary of the crash of the Hindenburg. But that's May 6th. Larry Hancock will be rejoining us, and I hope you'll join us for that as well. Well, we're just waiting for the call from Joe Trom, so if you'd like to call in while we're waiting for Joe's call, feel free to do that. The number here is 347-994-3796. And if you don't choose to call in this week, then feel free to do that with us next week. And you missed your chance because I think Joe is about to join us. 1, 2, 3. Are you there, Joe? There we go. Are you there, Joe? Okay, terrific. Welcome.
Thank you.
How are you, sir?
Thank you very much. By the way, there is another major anniversary on this date. I was just watching the ball game while I was waiting to go on, and it's the anniversary of the day Jackie Robinson broke the color line.
How? That's great. That was 1955?
No, 1947.
Oh, well, that's right, 47, that's right. I should remember as it being before I was born. In 55, I was already around. But, 1947 with the Brooklyn Dodgers.
Yes, yes, and every one of the ball players today is wearing number 42, so it's pretty
That's
nice
great.
Tribute.
Yeah, do you remember who the first African-American in the American League was?
Yes, from New Jersey.
Who?
Larry Doby.
Larry Doby is right, with? That was the Cleveland Indians, wasn't it? Yeah, yeah, I'm pretty sure it was. And that was when the Cleveland Indians were owned by Bill Veeck.
Okay. You're ahead of me
there. You're going to have to trust me on that. Bill Veeck owned at various times the Baltimore, what were they called? No, I'm sorry, the St. Louis Browns, who later became the Baltimore Orioles, the Cleveland Indians, and the Chicago White Sox. And no, I'm not that much of a baseball fan. I just know about Veeck.
Mm-hmm.
But we're now talking about you. Joe Trom has written a book that has been published called Waking Up. It is a mystery, I guess you would also call it a suspense novel. And he has some interesting experiences which play out in the book. Before we talk more about the book, why don't you tell us about your experience and how you came to write the novel?
Sure. I wanted, when I was young, before you were born.
Yes, sir.
Well, maybe not before you were born, but when
Probably
I was
not.
Younger, when I was in college, writing was something I loved. Even though I was a business major, I was editor-in-chief of my college paper. And I wanted to go on to study journalism, but when I learned that the accounting firms, and this is back in 1964, were offering the incredible amount of $130 a week.
Wow.
I was working for my uncle at $1.50 an hour, so I said, I can't pass this up. I'll go to the business world for a couple of years, make my fortune, and then I'll go back to school. And
well, to be fair, before you go on, in 1964, $130 a week was not terrible money. It was pretty good.
Huge, huge. Yeah. Actually, when I went into the U.S. Navy, I went back to $18 a week, and that became a bit tough.
Really? Yeah.
But then,
anyway, go on with.
Then life intervened, marriage, children, putting children through college and stuff. And finally, I reached the point where I was facing retirement and looking forward to it because now I could pursue my dream. I could write. It took a while to retire. I finished my career working for a Japanese firm, and
that was no longer in accounting, right? You were working in real estate by that time.
Oh, okay. I left a lot out because I didn't think anybody would be much interested in it. But,
oh, I'm sure they are. Go ahead.
Around 1971, I was working on the audit of a real estate company, and they made me an offer to go to work for them, and that was my first foray into real estate.
Okay.
And I found it lots and lots of fun because unlike most assets that you trade in, stocks and bonds and stuff, they're pieces of paper, but this is real stuff.
Mm-hmm.
See it, feel it, touch it, do stuff with it, even use it to forward social purposes.
Right.
And so I enjoyed it. I stayed in it. I became what's called a real estate investment banker and did that until I retired in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, the last few years of which were with a Japanese company.
Right.
I did want to retire and begin a writing career. I always loved to write, Jeff.
Right.
Anytime we needed to put together a brochure to market properties or to try to get somebody to lend us money against properties, I always volunteered to write it.
Right.
When meetings were held, I wanted to write the minutes. In fact, one of my colleagues gave me a great compliment. He said that he never minds missing a meeting when I take the minutes, because when you read Joe's minutes, you were there.
Well, that is a great compliment, and I've got to tell you, the reason I laughed when you said I volunteered to take the minutes is because, as a rule, I mean, that's very journalistic writing, but it's not necessarily what most of us would consider exciting stuff.
No, and that was my problem as I faced retirement and said, okay, now I'm going to write. I didn't know how. I mean, I knew how to put brochures together, and as you said, I could take minutes of meetings, but minutes of meetings, no matter how exciting the meeting is not is not a work of fiction. And so I trained for a year at a place in New York City called the Gotham Writers Workshop.
And you were there for the full year, full-time, pretty much?
I wasn't full-time, although it basically became full-time, because when I wasn't there, I was mostly working at home on studying, on writing, on reviewing other people's work.
What did you find the workshop experience like?
A bit intimidating. At the very beginning, in fact, the first day that I went there, the person that walked into the room to face all these bright-eyed people, a man named Dave Koch, he introduced himself as an author and an editor. And he told us that he was going to teach us literary fiction and not, and he looked like he was going to spit on the floor, and not genre fiction. And I thought, great.
Now,
I know what genre fiction is,
but for those of our listeners who may not, why don't you explain what the distinction is?
Well, actually, what I thought when Dave mentioned that was great. I'm one sentence into my new career, and I have no idea what this man is talking about. it took me a while to understand it. Remember the Supreme Court justice who called something pornographic, and when the lawyer asked for a definition, the justice said, I know it when I see it? Well, often that's the criteria for determining if something is literary fiction. The best way I can explain it is that genre fiction is intended to tell the reader what happens, while literary fiction is meant to tell the reader why it happens.
Right, and also generally when you're talking about genre fiction, it's usually categorized in various ways, like the mystery, the suspense, the romance novel, and so forth, right?
Oh, of course, but you know, you can have wonderful mysteries that are considered literary fiction.
Absolutely.
Or romance novels like Lolita, that's considered literary fiction.
Sure. Absolutely. Anyway, go on with what you were telling us in terms of your experience in history.
The craft training was, of course, wonderful for me, because I didn't know things like how to stay in a consistent point of view, how to develop a theme, how to find your voice, and even the rudiments of how to write dialogue and setting. But the most scary part of the Gotham Writers Workshop were these sessions where you were workshopped. You would write a short story. Now we would write short stories, because if you write a novel and it's bad, you wasted a lot of time. But if you write a short story and it's bad, go ahead and write another one.
Right.
And every periodically, when you finished your short story, it would be distributed to the group, and the professionals and some of your peers, the other students, would sit down and critique your work. You were said to go into the booth. The operative letters of the word booth are B-O-O. It gets you used to criticism.
Right. I was going to say, that can be devastating for a lot of people. Can end a lot of writing careers right there.
Well, it was very interesting. I had had a whole career, unlike most of these 20-somethings that were there with me. And so I had spent many, many years taking criticism, so it was nothing new. In any event, I think that one of the moments in the Gotham Writers Workshop was one of the singular moments that I just love being part of. You know, most of the criticism was given with the best of intentions to help make the work better. But then there was this one person, and whose identity I'll mask, because some of your listeners may know who she is. I'm going to call her Vanessa. She seemed to take particular enjoyment in making an author squirm, and she was good at it, like the guy on American Idol TV show. I remember one of her comments in particular. As required, I distributed my story on a Thursday. which gave all the participants the weekend to read it, and my session was scheduled for Tuesday. On Monday, Vanessa stopped me saying she had something to tell me. She had gone to Maine to visit her mother for the weekend and had taken my story along, and when she slept late on Saturday morning, her mother had read the story, and her mother had loved it. And I couldn't believe these words were coming from her, so I said, thank you, Vanessa. That's so nice of you to tell me. Well, she looked at me sternly and said, Joe, you have to understand something. My mother is a stupid woman.
That is great. I mean, it's great comedy. It was lousy for you, but it's a very funny story.
Well, the ironic thing, Jeff, is it kind of leads into things because that short story that I presented, I called Waking Up.
There you
go. I had first written what has now become a novel as a short story. And when I looked at my comments from the workshop, I found more were positive than negative. In fact, one of the editors had said, thanks for a great ride. So
that's great.
Well, you know, now all I have to do is just blow it up from 30 pages to 416. No problem. Give me a week or two and I'll get it.
It's a cakewalk, yeah. Yeah, so you, in fact, went ahead and did it from there. You went ahead and created the novel, which I assume took a while.
It took a while. It didn't take as long as some people that I've met. There's a man, Charles Bach, who wrote this fabulous book, The Beautiful Children. It took him 10 years. And I remember asking him, he was in the same Gotham Writers program that I was in, although years earlier. And I said to him, 10 years? And he said, I didn't want to get it done. I wanted to get it right. So I took that part. It took me a little less than 10 years. It took me about 14 months.
That's still a long time. I was just going to say, you know, one of the problems with taking 10 years to do something, or taking a very long time to do it, I mean, the fact is, I assume he was doing other things during that 10-year period. But one of the things that happens if you're talking about a work of writing, a work of art like that, is you can spend all that time on it, and then nothing happens, no matter how good you think it is. And the idea of, I just spent 10 years of my life on this thing, and no one wants to use it for anything but wrapping paper. Well, that would be a little scary, I would think.
Especially in this business, you know how difficult it is.
Yeah.
I had gone to writers' conferences, and I was all set to pitch my work. I had this wonderful short story. Even Vanessa's mother liked it.
We know about her. Go ahead.
And I was told, basically, if you want to pitch a work of fiction, write it.
Uh-huh.
Don't come to us with an idea. You know, maybe John Grisham could do that, but you can't.
Right.
And so I went and I wrote it. And then, of course, the process began. Actually, it took me 14 months to write it. It took another 8 months to revise it.
Yeah, I need to probably interject an explanation here, because writers will know what you were just referring to, but non-writers or non-professionals won't. So let me just mention to them that when you're talking about don't come to us with an idea, for a non-fiction book, you typically submit a book proposal as to what you want to write about, and you do some other things in there, such as talking about who the potential audience is and so forth. But with a work of fiction, that's, as a general rule, what you said, of course, is the case. Editors don't want to see a proposal. They want to see the writing. They want to see the book.
Yes, for nonfiction, generally you need a little bit more than a simple proposal. You need outlines. You need chapter headings.
Sample chapters.
Yes, but yes, generally it's easier to pitch an it's possible to pitch an incomplete work of nonfiction. Very difficult or almost impossible to work of fiction. After revising it, I felt it was time to take it on the road, and I think I mentioned this in an email to you this week.
Right.
I was listening to one of your guests, Michael Cogdill, who said to the listeners, "Don't get discouraged if you send your proposal out to 25 agents and they all reject you." And at 25, I was just getting warmed up.
Right. How many places, if you know, because you may have lost count, how many places did you send your work?
There were, the list of agents totaled 147. And the list of publishers totaled six. There were only six publishers who said they accepted unsolicited manuscripts.
Right, and the unsolicited manuscripts are those that are not done typically through agents. Those are done by the authors, what they call over the transom.
Yes.
Okay, go ahead, please.
Yes, and then when I started, I mean, I worked very hard to do my homework. Of course, I went through the web and tried to find,
sure,
through Publishers Marketplace and other sources, lists of agents that seemed like they specialized in the kind of work I had produced.
Mm-hmm.
I had gone to some of my favorite authors like Elmore Leonard, and
sure,
when he thanked his agent, I put down the name and found out where they were.
Mm-hmm.
I had relied on some sources. I had some friends who had successfully gotten fiction published, and they gave,
mm-hmm,
me a couple of leads. And along the way, I had several agents who seemed interested. They were interested enough to ask for additional chapters, or even in a couple of cases, the entire manuscript.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing had happened until I sent a query to an agent called Metropole Literary, and unbeknownst to me, the head of Metropole Literary was also a publisher. Drew Netterpelt had two houses under his leadership, Cambridge House Press and Sterling and Ross. And
great.
Although he wasn't interested in repping me as an agent, he sent me an email saying that he could be very interested in publishing me. So it sounded good to me.
That must have been a great day.
No, because, Jeff, I'd had so many false starts.
Right.
I mean, one day I remember there's an agent, Jennifer Joel, who works with ICM, International Creative Management, the
big, mm-hmm,
agency.
Big agency.
They represent,
mm-hmm,
stars. My old real estate company used to share an elevator bank with them. And
okay,
there were days when going up the elevator was the highlight of the day. One day I shared an elevator with Michelle Pfeiffer.
Hey, not bad.
Anyway, when Jennifer Joel responded to my query and said that I'd like to see 50 pages, I was so excited. I mean, I was envisioning,
sure,
the dinner I was going to have with Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie to talk about the movie.
Yeah.
And as I was driving in the car, I went through a red light. Fortunately,
yeah,
I didn't hit anybody, and nobody,
right,
hit me, and there wasn't a police officer around, but you kind of can get carried away with that.
Sure.
When I did get Drew's indication of interest, it was fine. I sent him stuff like I had done with others. Then he asked for the whole manuscript, and then I got a very chilling email telling me they were going to editorial committee. And then on the Monday before Thanksgiving in 2008, I got another email, and I was terrified to open it. Because,
sure,
just like when my son got his letter from Cornell, he let it sit on his desk for 2 days. He was afraid to open it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it's a scene I use in the book. But finally, my wife took me by the hand and walked me over to the computer and said, come on, Joe, let's open it together. And
let's do it, right.
And that was it. They made an offer to acquire the work. We hammered out a contract in a couple of weeks. And that very same day, as luck would have it,
mm-hmm,
I received a contract from an agent in the mail.
How funny.
That same day. So I had opened up the letter, and I had the contract in my hand, and I said, I can just go ahead and sign with this guy. My wife said, what, are you crazy? You might already have a publisher. And I said, well, I don't know. I'm afraid to open the email.
Right. That's
anyway,
funny.
It was a couple
Did you actually end up going with the agent as well, or just you went direct with the publisher and that was it?
No, I went direct with the publisher because, many, if your listeners are thinking this is the typical way to do it, it isn't. Jeff,
no,
right. I probably, no, in most circumstances, would have been better off signing with the agent, letting him rep me with the publisher, but I had negotiated so many contracts in my life, I felt totally,
right,
comfortable doing that with the help of a lawyer that I trusted, and I felt there was no need to involve an agent, at least not this time around. But I,
mm-hmm,
promised him that for the next book, that we'll, you know, I'll talk with him first.
That's terrific. That's a great story. Let me ask you, speaking of stories, to briefly describe the book. And then I want to talk about where it's available, so make sure we save some time for that. Go ahead, please.
Okay, very briefly. Michael Hayes is the name of a very successful real estate investment banker who suffers a terrible personal tragedy when his 11-year-old son is kidnapped and killed. The police appear to make little progress in solving the crime, so Hayes undertakes his own investigation using the techniques that made him successful in his real estate business. The search for the murderer takes Hayes to colorful locales around the world, including Japan, surprise, surprise, where he interacts with lots of memorable characters. And all the while, even as the intensity of the investigation grows, Hayes continues to work for a living, and the reader gets to accompany him into the negotiating room as he manages real estate transactions. Yes, it is a murder mystery. I called it a thriller, but then I was told, no, that's wrong. Thriller is where the hero is in jeopardy all the time.
Now I can't remember the character Jack Ryan.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't remember who. Yeah, that's
Tom Clancy.
That's a thriller. Tom Clancy, yes, thank you. That's a thriller because the guy's always, you know, in trouble and getting himself out. Kind of like Little Lulu in another context. But anyway, so...
Okay, well, it's interesting that you brought up Clancy because he's a guy who, when you read something like The Hunt for Red October, you'll be told how a submarine works.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a tremendous amount of research he does, and he writes it so beautifully, and I'm not sure how many people want to know how a submarine works, but it's there for you. You know, there was the song Billy Joel did about Paul, the real estate novelist, in his song Piano Man. That's what I envision myself, a real estate novelist. You know, although the novel is fiction and the characters are all from my imagination, the one thing I tried to make sure of was that the real estate activity is real.
Right, and you can do based on your experience.
Absolutely. At Gotham, I mean, they taught us that fiction has to be more honest than nonfiction. So everything that I could make true, such as how real estate wheeling and dealing takes place, I believe I did.
That's great. And also in your book, your protagonist has an assistant, essentially.
Yes, and the assistant serves a couple of purposes. One, of course, real estate, at least at the higher levels, is done as a team.
Right.
And one person acting alone isn't going to get it done.
Michael
Hayes is a certain type. The title of the book is Waking Up, and although Waking Up is how the book begins, my character is awakened in the middle of the night by a phone call from a kidnapper saying, I have your son, and I'm about to murder him. There's another aspect of waking up that I was striving for. For many of us, things happen while we're awake. And although we see them happening and even participate in them, we're sometimes oblivious, asleep for the meaning. We need to metaphorically wake up in time and act in a way to prevent such things from negatively affecting us and those we love. And that's the kind of waking up the title reflects. Michael Hayes is somebody that needs to do that. Jimmy Young, his assistant, is somebody who, unlike Hayes, who grew up in unremarkably in an area of the New York metropolitan area called Jersey City. Jimmy Young grew up a child of privilege, but she hasn't let that affect what she has become. She has flaws, and the key to the novel is if she can deal with and overcome them. Unlike Hayes, who has allowed himself to become filled up like a balloon with himself. She stayed grounded.
And she also brings some expertise to the table in terms of what she knows in terms of Japan and so forth, right?
Yes. That comes in early on in the book. I wouldn't want to spoil anything for your listeners.
I'm being
very careful here.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no question that her involvement on the team is critical. But then I tried to make it be very real, as in a real estate deal. Everyone's involvement on the team is critical.
Yeah. Well, the book is called Waking Up, and it's available on Amazon.com, correct?
Yes, it is. And just for fun, Jeff, because I know you have an interest in the real estate business, I sent emails to many of the people that I worked with over the years, telling them that my book was finally coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I got some funny ones back saying, you retired in 05? Gosh, it doesn't seem that long. But don't worry, you haven't missed anything. The business hasn't been that great. But the funny thing is, all of the shopping center guys that I sent emails to all sent me back something and said, I don't care if it's available on Amazon. I will only buy in a bookstore.
Really?
Well, I can understand that. If you're in the shopping center industry, that's where you want to thrive.
That makes perfect sense. I have to acquit myself here. I haven't bought a book through Amazon for a long time. I almost always go into a Barnes and Noble, but not for that reason, frankly. It had not occurred to me, but that makes perfect sense. You want to support the people, especially locally, who are doing business and stocking the books and providing an income to authors, and also the people in your community who are running the shopping centers. I hadn't thought of that, but that's certainly true.
That's a real estate, a realtor's mentality. I remember sitting at conferences, the big shopping center conferences held annually in Las Vegas, usually between Mother's Day and Memorial Day.
Okay.
And it's a lot of fun to go there, but there was a time when people were terrified. The internet is going to ruin us, put us out of business.
Yeah.
Who's going to go to a shopping center? And things like books, it's quite easy to sit at the computer and pound away. And heck, look at how easy Amazon makes it. You can go on Amazon.com. You can read the first chapter of Waking Up. You can pick a page and read it.
Right.
It's a very annoying utility to do it this way, but you might be able to read the whole book. I don't think they allow you to do too many pages at a time, but then you can go back and do it again.
Yeah, but it reaches a point where if you're that interested, go buy the darn book.
Yeah. And then now, of course, with the Kindle coming out.
And the iPad.
Comment on that. People that have it have told me they love it. I don't have one. But a friend of mine who's in the real estate business was going on vacation to a couple of exotic places, Egypt and Jordan, and he said he has a Kindle, but he would never take it on vacation because he could envision walking off the plane and having it fall out of his backpack, and then he has nothing to read the entire vacation. Literally, he has a book, and it falls to the ground. It doesn't break.
Right. And the thing is that the fact is there is something tactile and rewarding about having a physical book. I'm sorry, I've been looking at technical stuff for a long time. I'm kind of a computer geek, and the Kindle and the Nook, which is Barnes and Noble's product, and now the iPad, they may all have wonderful features to them and be terrific and a lot of fun for some things. But to be honest with you, I would rather have a physical book. When they talk about being able to store, I don't know, whatever it is, 7,000 books on a Kindle or an iPad, how many can you read at a time?
Right. I had gone to meet with a book club here, a group of former teachers, and one of whom had read the book on the Kindle. All the rest had the book. And she said that an advantage she had was that you can put the book down. You know, many times you put a book down and then you start up again and you run into a character and you say, oh, you know, I remember that character's name, but I don't exactly remember what she did. And you can actually just type in the name and it takes you right back to the spot where you can check on her as opposed to flipping pages.
Okay.
So that's, that's nice. But
I agree with you.
I'd rather have a book in my hand.
Yeah, I don't know if you remember this or ever read the books when you were a kid, the Perry Mason novels by Earl Stanley Gardner.
Oh, of course.
Okay. At the beginning of each of those books, and I think Ellery Queen novels did this too, but at the beginning of each of the Perry Mason books, they had a description of the name of each of the characters who were going to appear and a description of them. So that, theoretically, if you weren't able to retain in your brain who somebody was, you could go back to the beginning of the book, see him, oh, yeah, that's the Restless Redhead or whatever. You know, you could figure it out that way. And my own opinion about that is, frankly, if you have that much trouble remembering who the character is, it was either a problem with the book, meaning no disrespect to you in terms of what she was saying, or the reader, more likely the latter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in terms of not being able to retain it. But But for what my opinion is worth.
That's fair, although there is interesting, again, I have to be very careful here because I don't want to give it away, but there's a very important scene near the end, and I had to set it up by describing a character. And when my editor, and that editing process, Jeff, that is awful. But
yeah, I'm sure.
When my editor went through and pounded me into the ground, one of the things she said was, this came out of nowhere, this scene that happened. And I said, no, I set it up. And I showed her how 5 or 6 chapters earlier I had set it up.
Right.
And she said, by the time I got there, I forgot. Now, this is somebody who's reading every word and every single word critically. So it can happen to the best of them.
No, I'm sure that's true. I'm sure.
But she made me not only set it up once, I set it up twice.
Right. I was going to say, what she was really saying is you need to refresh the reader's memory a little bit here.
Exactly.
Essentially, yeah. Well, that's great. In spite of what we just said about buying the book, which is a good thing in a bookstore, besides Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com, you may want to look at JoeTraum.com, JoeTraum, last letter M as in Mary.com. And we've got about 3 minutes left, more or less. What are you working on now?
The second novel is also real estate-oriented. It's not a prequel or a sequel. It's totally different, and in fact, it's relevant to this timing because I believe that they are memorializing the Holocaust now, that it's whatever it was, 65 years since the U.S. and were able to free the prisoners. This book envisions two babies who were rescued at the end of the war. And although they were not, it was not known whether or not they were brothers, they were both taken by different families. One went to Canada, one went to the U.S. And although, again, they didn't know if the boys were brothers, the families kept in touch with one another, and the boys grew up very close, notwithstanding their geographic difference. And both went into the real estate business. And when Ralph's company decides to make an investment in the United States, who would he call but his old buddy Max?
Sure.
And Max doesn't treat him properly. I call the book The Ultimate Betrayal.
It sounds like kind of a Cain and Abel. So I don't mean the book by the British guy, but I mean the biblical Cain and Abel.
Okay.
Anyway, Joe. No, I mean there's some. Yeah, it's interesting. Anyway, we've got about 2 minutes left. When is that other book coming out?
Oh,
you're not done with it yet.
Lucky,
probably.
I'll be finished with it 4 to 6 months from now.
Okay.
And then begin the whole process of rewriting, editing.
Okay.
You know, editing. Waking up took almost a year.
That's amazing. That's a long time.
Rachel Trusheim, who's the executive editor of Cambridge House Press, is very exacting.
Yeah.
And as the comment was made, better to get it right than to get it done.
Yes, in that case, that's certainly true. I'm still not sure I would give 10 years over to working on a novel, but it's... But I'm eager to read yours, as I'm sure that the other folks who are listening are. And I almost destroyed that sentence. And again, you can get Waking Up by Joe Traum at all of the popular and probably many of the less popular, unpopular bookstores, right?
And Jeff, this was so much fun talking to you. I've been listening to your show for a couple of months now.
That's very kind.
I discovered it, and I love it. It's great because here in the East Coast, it's 11:30 at night, and it leads into one of the wonderful days of the week, Friday, and then into the weekend. So it's a great way to start what I call the extended weekend.
That's very kind of you. I appreciate the kind words. And you too. It was a pleasure speaking with you, and I hope we've ended up moving a number of people to your site and to your book.
Well, thank you again, Jeff.
Thank you, Joe. Take care.
Okay, have a good.
All right, you too. Bye-bye. And that was Joe Traum, who joined us on Speaking of Everything. And you joined us too, although obviously we didn't have any callers during that time, which is great because we were able to talk and explore that with Joe. Please join us next week. We will be speaking with author Deanna Day and have all kinds of news and discussions, and you can participate. That's basically it for now. Today is the 15th. I want to thank our esteemed producer who is sleeping in her doggy bed. Autumn, and let you go, and hope to see you next week. In the meantime, have a great week. Thanks for joining us. So long.